And then I will show you how we can derive a model that that is simple enough to analyze and is moderately realistic. And then I'll show you some results. And I'll tell you up front that unlike some of the other talks we heard this week, I don't have all the answers, and it's not a closed story. So there will be some loose ends at the end, which remain pretty interesting. So the visual cortex is the first part of the mammalian cortex that receives input from the visual system after it's gone through the eye and to this relay center, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and then there's a mapping to the cortical sheet. And the quantities that I'm interested in have to do with the geometry of these projections of where these nerve fibers go. And so I'm going to be looking at things very geometrically. We've heard a number of talks this week describing neurons, individual neurons and their dynamics in various levels of detail. We learned that it may be true that all neural models are equivalent. Some are more equivalent than others. If you look at the differences between Hodgkin-Huxley and integrate and fire and theta models, I'm going to be taking a much coarser view. I don't think it's in focus yet. That's better. And just lumping together the activities of many, many neurons in a population, which is the level of which the empirical data exists that describes the large-scale anatomy of the visual cortex, which is mostly optical imaging data, which I'll be showing you some shortly. So what we've got is the basic object of interest is the synaptic weights from an input layer, which you can think of as the retina or the thalamus, the LGN, projecting into the cortex. So here's a point or a cell A in the cortex which is getting input that's distributed over the plane of the input layer. Here's another cell with another distribution of input. And the geometric properties of those I'm going to try to use to explain the existence of a number of patterns. This is maybe a little bit hard to see. This is a staining of the cat visual cortex for a marker cytochrome oxidase that indicates regions of cell populations that have higher metabolic activity. And so this is a blow-up of this little region here, and it may be possible for you to make out, it's clearer in the original publication, little sort of a hexagonal network of slightly darkened patches. So I apologize if this is hard to see. This is what you deal with with biological data. So there's a roughly hexagonal network of spot patterns, which indicates cells that seem to be more metabolically active. And one way that you can look at this is that perhaps they are getting more input than the other cells around them, which indicates that there may be some sort of non-uniformity in the structure of this feed-forward synaptic weight pathway. So let me define, given the synaptic weight field W of X and R, if I integrate over the input layer, as shown here, then I get something that I call the cortical fan-in, or the net input weight, which I like using this little symbol. It sort of represents everything coming up into a point in the upper layer, and it's a function of X. And you can also define, if you look at this as a matrix of elements connecting position X and from position R, this is just either the row or the column sum, one or the other. And of course, you can define the complementary quantity, the fan out from the lower layer, which has, for aesthetic reasons, I chose the symbol that's the curly wedge up. Right, so this is all the weight coming out from one of these points, and it's just the integral over the top layer of the weight from a particular point. Unfortunately, some of my slides coming up are from PowerPoint, which has a limited selection of symbols, and so this may be represented by, the input may be represented by M for mass, and this one by omega, which is sort of an M upside down. I'll ask you to be flexible with the notation. Okay, so one of the basic, probably the basic insight into the organization of the cortex that has come about in the last 30 years is the columnar organization of cortical properties. Hubel and Wiesel's Nobel Prize-winning work showed that if you look at the cortical surface, which is actually a layered structure, as you penetrate through the layers, you find cells that have very similar response properties. And as we've heard before in Paul Breslau's talk, cells in the cortex, most of them are very highly tuned for particular orientations, and they're also tuned for particular positions in the visual field. And if you make a vertical penetration through the layers, all of those cells essentially prefer roughly the same orientation at roughly the same point in space. If you go to another point in the cortex, you have a new location, and as you move across gradually, the orientation shifts in a mostly systematic way with occasional jumps. I'm trying to go through this fast so I don't run out of time at the end, but if anybody has questions or something's unclear. What is plotted here, this is the receptive field of the cell, so in visual field coordinates, in X and Y in the visual field, the area where a particular cell responded to either a dot of light or a bar. I guess a bar, because cortical cells don't respond to punctate stimuli very well. So this represents a variety of cells that were recorded along this tract, and they're all roughly in the same place. Good. Other questions? So let me tell you a little bit more about these two maps. I promised Andrew, who's talking later about hallucinations, that I would mention the retinotopic map, so he wouldn't have to. This is a half-field flickering black and white stimulus that was shown to a monkey, and the the activity of the cells was indicated by staining the cortex with an activity-sensitive marker. So you see here later the tissue was developed, and these patterns were actually observable directly in the surface of the cortical tissue. So these vertical bars correspond to the concentric rings, and the radii are these. And you can see there's sort of an interesting map here. It's approximately given, you can see it's approximate, by the complex logarithm. That is to say, r and theta here go to log r in this direction roughly, and theta in this direction roughly. On a finer scale, if you look sort of inside one of these little grids, this is a centimeter, but if you look at a square of just a couple millimeters on a side, the mapping is actually quite smooth from visual field coordinates to cortical coordinates. This is data that recently came out from David Fitzpatrick's lab, where he gave a long, thin stimulus, like the shadow of this pointer, and moved it back and forth across the visual field, and then recorded optically the activity of cells in the cortex responding to that. That particular direction happened to match this sort of horizontal direction in the cortex, and as he did this little wiggling stimulus at different points, each of these is moving by 1 degree in the visual field. You can see that there's a steady progression of the sort of center of this horizontal region of activity that moves down. If you plot the roughly the position of the center of the curve you get in the cortex for a given location. So this is, these two are, let's see, from here to here is 10 degrees apart. So this is 2.5, 2.5, and 2.5. So the center moves progressively. You get this nice linear relationship with a lot of scatter. So one can approximate, and the scale of millimeters, one can approximate the mapping from visual field to cortical coordinates as a linear map up to some rotation and magnification factor. If you look at on a finer scale, there are distortions because individual cells, you saw there was a lot of visual field scatter, and individual cells may not be doing exactly what the average says. And there's a debate in the field right now as to whether those deviations are systematic. So if you take a local average of the visual field position and you may and you compare that to the underlying unaveraged map, then you can define a vector field, which is the local distortion. So this x over mu would just be, given the magnification factor, a linear mapping in the position coordinates. The actual retinotopic position would be R, and the difference would be a little vector field on the cortex, which is the fine-grain distortion. Okay, how are these maps structured? Gary Blaisdell, using optical imaging techniques, came up with this data describing the overall arrangement of the orientation map. The little line segments indicate the orientation in the visual field that a particular stimulus preferred, and you can see that this map, and then the color code just goes around the circle. So there are singularities, points where all the orientations come together. There are linear zones where the orientation is changing gradually, and there are occasionally fractures where there's a rapid change of orientation kind of along a line structure.
Yes? Is this done with many animals or one animal?
This is one animal with presenting many stimuli. So many you present a vertical bars and horizontal bars, and you look at the difference in activation at each pixel that you're picking up the cortical activity with. And you do the same for the obliques, and then you get a vector field from that. This is roughly a 3x4 millimeter patch.
Is it stationary?
Yes. This is an anatomically stable. People have been able to implant little windows over the cortex and do the same experiment over time, watch them develop in immature animals as they grow, and these maps form very early, and then they're very stable. And finally, there's different cells not only have preferential responses to position and orientation, but also to spatial frequency. And the spatial frequency has an organized map, which seems to be correlated with the orientation map. Here's an orientation map. Here's the contours of the orientation map. There's a pinwheel that corresponds to this pinwheel. And this pseudocolor map shows areas of high, low, and medium orientation preference. And by and large, the singularities of the orientation map lie at the extrema, either near the high or near the low spatial frequency, and avoid the medium spatial frequency regions. So these maps are coupled together. And there's data from Aniruddha Das suggesting that there's also coupling between the orientation map and the retinotopic map. So he did a series of painstaking experiments where he recorded both the optical image and then went into individual cells and recorded their receptive field structure and looked at, if for a given change in the orientation map, how big of a change is there in the retinotopic map. One might think that these would be independent. There's some modeling evidence to suggest that in order to have as smooth a map as possible of all the different features in the cortex, you would want to have dislocations in the two maps avoid each other so that the overall map had a minimal sort of gradient. But in fact, he found the opposite. He found that the dislocations in one were correlated with the dislocations in the other. So where you had jumps in orientation, like in the pinwheels, you also tended to get jumps in the retinotopic position. And I should say that's a somewhat controversial result, but I've talked to Aniruddha about this a lot, and the experiments were very carefully done, so it's very interesting to think about. Okay, so for a geometric description, the way that I want to approach this is looking at this feedforward weight as a geometric object, and let me just review a couple of things. We've got the input mass. This is where this ought to be a little curly wedge up and this curly wedge down. So the input mass, the fan out, the retinotopic position is just the mean in the input plane. It's the first moment. And the second moment in the input plane of the weight distribution gives you a covariance matrix. And from the covariance matrix, you can derive a vector that gives you the orientation. If these little piles of synaptic weight are oriented in one direction or another, you can actually infer the direction of the orientation and the magnitude from the eccentricity of that elliptic profile. You can see how strong the orientation tuning would be and what direction the orientation preference would be in. So the idea is these patterns all have sort of a common wavelength. And there's a theory that many of you are very familiar with, going back to 1952, for how you form patterns like this in biological systems. And one of the ingredients you need is long-range inhibition or lateral inhibition and local excitation. And we have exactly that in the visual cortex. We have a very dusty slide, which I just made this morning. So how can it be dusty? We have both excitatory and inhibitory cells in the cortex making lateral connections. And Paul talked in his talk about the locally isotropic connections. Those include both the inhibitory and the excitatory ones. And it's not entirely implausible that there's an effective center surround distribution for the way points in the cortex influence each other. I'm going to assume that sort of interaction is present, and combine it with a fundamental learning rule that is pretty well established, the Hebbian learning rule, where the connections between a particular part of the input space and a particular part of the output space tend to increase the strength of that connection if the firing of those two areas is correlated, and decrease if it's anti-correlated. There are refinements of this rule that have come to light in the last few years, which are applicable to a finer scale description of the neurons. But since I'm lumping together whole populations of neurons, I'm going to stick to this coarser, sort of old-fashioned Hebbian learning. So if we've got an activity in the cortex and an image, an activity in the input layer, and averaging over many, many epochs, if these two are correlated, then we are going to increase the synaptic weight. We also need a weight decay term, and we're going to need some higher order terms to keep the weights from exploding. I have to make a linear approximation for the relationship between the input signals and the cortical activity. Namely, you get the feed forward image weighted by the synaptic weights, and then you convolve that with the lateral connections. And making the assumption that the correlation function between the input activity at two different points is circularly symmetric and translation invariant, I get an E2 equivariant weight dynamics. Of this form, the way the weights evolve is given by this linear convolution plus the decay term plus some nonlinearities that are very important biologically, but I'm not going to be able to talk about them too much because today, for the coupling of the different feature maps, you only can look at the linear part, and that's about as far as you can go. But so this is the full dynamics. There's the term I just showed you with the weight decay, and there are some logistic saturation terms to prevent the net input or the net fan out or fan in from growing too much. And of course, during the break, if anybody wants more details, I could talk about this for hours. All right. I worked on it for 6 years, and I can talk about it for 6 hours. So, the way that we proceed is by finding a steady state for those weight dynamics, which is isotropic, Euclidean invariant, linearizing around that steady state and analyzing unstable modes that occur at a symmetry breaking bifurcation. But this space of weights is really quite too large. You know, we have functions from on R2 cross R2. And the data are on this sort of feature map vector field scale. And what we need is a way of reducing this fine-grained description to a coarser-grained description. And that's what we're going to do. So here's the uniform steady state. The weights are just taken to be some sort of Gaussian function of the cortical position minus the corresponding position in the visual field. And so if you were to plot the receptive fields of a grid of cells in the cortex in this state, it would look like so. Each cell has a little round receptive field that's the same as all the others, and they're spaced uniformly without any retinotopic distortion. And by looking at a deviation from that steady state, so you imagine that you've got essentially little Gaussian receptive fields, and now you let them start to elongate a little bit, so they start to have a little bit of orientation preference. Or you let the middles shift around, so that now you no longer have a uniform retinotopic map. Or you let some of them grow and some of them shrink, or some of them get broader and some of them narrower. There are, from those 0th, 1st, and 2nd moments that I defined, the input mass, the retinotopic position, and then the orientation, and the sixth part of that vector that you can describe as part of the second moment is the width, or the net variance. Those six objects, which are all linear functionals of the synaptic weight, give you a six-dimensional vector describing the cortical feature map that includes input mass, or what would be stained by cytochrome oxidase, the retinotopic position, the orientation map, and the spatial frequency, which, if you have a larger receptive field, you're looking at lower spatial frequencies. If you have a narrower receptive field, you're looking at higher spatial frequencies. So by performing that reduction, we get a dynamics at the level of this vector field, which has this weight decay term. It has each of the components of the vector field is convolved with the same Mexican hat-shaped lateral interaction. And then we get from the coupling between the different components that the nonlinearities imposed, we get a matrix convolution here, which has got components in it like this. So this, you'll be coupling part of the orientation to part of the retinotopic, and vice versa, through this matrix with a variety of interesting looking kernels. Let me skip that and just say that linear dynamics for at the level of the feature map is equivariant with respect to E2 rotations. But it's the same funny kind of action of E2 that you see in describing the hallucination patterns. Namely, if you rotate, for example, the vector field representing the retinotopic distortion, that rotation acts in the usual way. You've got here's the vector field. You can see how it's distorted. If you rotate it by 180 degrees, then A goes down to A, and this little vector is pointing in the opposite direction because you've rotated the vector field by 180 degrees as well. But the orientation field, the rotation acts on that with a double angle action. And so if you take point C here, it rotates down to point C, so the whole pattern has been rotated by 180 degrees, but the orientation is the same. And so we have a different action on different components, and that leads to the formation of particular kinds of patterns that end up looking something like the observed maps. Okay, let me move along. So a couple talks have already explicitly mentioned the equivariant branching lemma. So the way I understand this lemma is when the uniform state becomes unstable, the kinds of solutions that you expect to emerge are the ones corresponding to a unique pattern. That's the axial subgroup, that is the subgroup whose fixed point space is one-dimensional. If the fixed point space were two-dimensional, that means there's two different patterns. Right? So which patterns or which solutions correspond to a unique pattern are liable to appear? Well, let's focus on the hexagonal case. So we're going to restrict to planar periodic solutions. For example, solutions that have a symmetry of a triangular lattice, or the hexagonal case. And in this case, if you've got one null eigenvector, you've got six because of the rotations. And so we have this matrix now can be written down explicitly after years of hard work as a 36 by 36 matrix that is equivariant with respect to D6 and the torus translations. And so it takes a block diagonal form, which you can write out explicitly using a nice projection formula based on Schur's lemma. Somebody had to mention Schur's lemma at this conference. Which splits, first of all, the space of solutions is split into an even component and an odd component under the reflection. And then within the even component, you get four identical blocks, 6x6 blocks, which all will have a common, which will become unstable together. And so within these blocks, within the even components, you've got the mass, which is a scalar, is even under reflections. If you imagine a pattern, say a traveling waves or stripes of mass, higher, lower, which is one of the fundamental modes. If you flip that upside down, you get the same thing if you flip it in the right place. Spatial frequency also is a scalar, and so it appears in the even irreducible representation. And then there's a positive component of the two-dimensional orientation field and a positive component of the retinotopic field, which both appear in the even component. In the odd component, there's an odd orientation pattern and a fundamental pattern or plane wave and an odd retinotopic pattern. When a null vector appears, it's either going to be in the even or the odd subspace, and it's going to, generically, it's going to include all of these components together with some coefficients. That is what leads to the coupling between different feature maps. It's a symmetry-induced property that just arises naturally if you describe the maps in this geometric way. And people have been puzzling over this for quite some time and arguing about whether things should be coupled or how, and it just arises naturally from a symmetry, from a pattern formation analysis. So if there's one thing I want you to take away from the talk, that's it, that the coupling between the different feature maps is a natural consequence of the underlying symmetry of the pattern formation problem. Any questions? Okay, that will be on the exam. All right, so what's that? Frank wants extra credit. Okay, so what do those two patterns look like that I mentioned? For the even irreducible, the combined retinotopic and orientation pattern look like so. It's a transverse wave.
And then we represent them each with some coefficients, and then the game is to write down the group action of these coefficients and find the fixed point subspaces. And the details in this case work exactly the same way as they do in the hallucination papers, which is important because the hallucination papers are published. I know this would be an excellent time to start the projection. So there are some things I want to show you that I have here, and some things that I whipped up last night in that lab, which is once the projector warms up, I can show you. So is it? Are there any questions at this point?
So this is Matt Kay. The exam question.
Yes.
So that came from the interaction between the various, taking the differential equation that you wrote for the wave. for the vector v.
So that's the linearization of the dynamics after you project onto this lower dimensional description, the six-dimensional description of the synaptic weights. And the way you do that projection is you say that the weights are approximately Gaussians with a deviation from Gaussian that is an extension in one direction or more mass or less mass or something like that.
But you said that then that this was computed with hard work, is the form of the matrix K?
Yes. Well, I mean, it was hard for me.
So how do you compute it? I mean, did you use some logical...
So you assume that the vector field is small. So when the vector field is all zeros, you have random vector fields. You have no orientation tuning. The deviation of the mass from a uniform input mass is zero. So you look at the deviations, right? Now you say, well, suppose that there's a non-zero feature map vector field. That means that now you've got the Gaussian, which was the steady state, and now you're going to stretch it out a little bit. So you're going to linearize the synaptic weight matrix in powers of epsilon. You're going to expand it in powers of epsilon, where epsilon describes how eccentric is it or how much bigger is it. And then, so you've got a whole bunch of Taylor expansions and involving these convolutions of different matrices, and you just have to keep track of a lot of things. Okay. Oh, good. This is on, and well, but I'm not quite ready to turn it either.
Move it to the side.
And
then
you see. Yeah. Let's. I have time to show you both of these things. I want to show you. This is great. It has a little handle and everything. Okay. Am I still on camera? So here's the basic solution for the odd. First, I'll show you the odd case, and then I'll show you the even case, and then I'll explain why I don't have transparency for the even case, because in some sense it's not even. But we'll get there. Okay, so in the odd case, you've got the odd roll pattern. You've got the odd rectangular pattern. Does anybody see where the orientation singularities are in that pattern? Points where all these different orientations come around. It'll be easier if I color code it for you. Here's the triangular pattern. Here's the hexagonal. Okay.
How big? What part of the cortex of these patterns are reproduced? 36 times or what?
That's right. If you've scaled this to look at the whole cortex, I have to be careful here because the retinotopic map. If you look at the whole cortex, the retinotopic map is not uniform and linear anymore with a small correction. There's a big systematic change. If I ignore that, then the orientation pattern, this is the hybrid column spacing, and so if you could fit in 36 hybrid columns, you get this pattern.
Okay, maybe I should rephrase the question slightly differently. With Blaisdell's picture, how many of these would go onto this picture?
This is one about one... roughly a square millimeter. Whereas that was 3 by 4, it would be 4 by 4, 3 by 4, something like that. Here's the color. Actually, maybe I can put them together. That works. That doesn't work. Okay. So, with the color coding, the rolls are either one direction or the other. The triangles, now it's easier to see that you've got these pinwheel singularities, just like in the real thing. This is an artifice of the color printer. There's not actually a cut there. Okay. So you've got plus and minus 1 pi or minus pi singularities. And the rectangular pattern here is a network of singularities. Again, just ignore this number here. And then the hexagonal pattern. Now, the hexagonal pattern has a problem. Anybody see the problem? In the hexagonal pattern, you've got a plus pi singularity and another plus pi, plus pi, plus pi. But here, you've got a minus 2 pi. It goes around twice. The orientation goes around twice. That never happens in the real data. You only see a single winding number, either positive or negative. And so I throw out this pattern and don't consider it anymore. Actually, fortunately, I think the hexagons are generically unstable. No? Okay, well. So I told you there were some loose ends here. That's one of them. And so the question of orientation and retinotopy being connected, it's not just that they're naturally coupled because of the way the symmetry breaking happens. When you put them together in the plan forms, you can actually say, for a given plan form, if I did an experiment like Das and Gilbert and I measured the orientation map and the dislocations between nearby points, would I get the right kind of correlations or not? Now, there's a choice here because the symmetry breaking solutions, both of those vectors are going to be, both of those, the orientation, the odd orientation and the odd retinotopy components are going to be present at the same time of the bifurcation, but the relative sign of them could be one or two things, meaning they could be out of phase, right? One could be shifted in the plane 180 degrees from the other. Now, there's reasons to think that a particular one is selected because that makes a smoother overall mapping, but in principle, different models can get different results. It turns out that whether you choose the same sign or the opposite sign, you get the same result for the correlation between the actual plan form, which is superposition, you get the same correlation between the rate of change of the one locally and the rate of change of the other. So,
can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
When you take that triangle plan form, called a triangle plan form. In fact, it has some symmetry. It's just a glide reflection symmetry.
It has more symmetry than it has D3 cross T2 and maybe something and a Z some sort.
Well, as a pattern, I mean, it just has a half translation down and a reflection.
Sure.
It's a PG type symmetry. Is there any significance in
that? Yeah, the plan forms are. So the symmetry that it has is a subgroup of the underlying D6 semi-direct product T2 symmetry that the hex lattice has. In fact, it's not just any subgroup. It has a subgroup whose fixed point space is one-dimensional. So it's what's called an axial subgroup. And it's precisely in the axial subgroups that we expect to see patterns when there's a minimal symmetry breakdown.
If I can help on that question, this is the odd platform.
Yeah.
These are the odds. So the odds do have the glide reflections in D3. When you reflect, you get a translation as well. I think that's what Mike was asking.
Okay.
And observing in the picture.
Okay, yes. It's there. Thank you. So if you look at the rate of change of the position in the visual field with respect to vision, position in the cortex, it's large at the places where the orientation map is changing quickly. Here's the gradient of the orientation map. And so these places of rapid change tend to line up. And in fact, the correlation coefficient, if you just look at where one's changing compared to the other's changing, you get a correlation coefficient of 0.3. which is positive, and it has the right sign. And now I'll show you, I'll take 2 minutes, is long enough. I'll show you the even patterns. Now, the problem with the even patterns is that they all make double singularities. That's why I didn't look at them until I thought it might be neat to show for this talk. So let's first look at the odd roll pattern, or the even roll pattern. Oops, there we go. So here's the even rolls. There's the orientation map. Here's the retinotopic map. The on this panel, I'll show the fanning weight. You can see it just goes higher and lower, higher and lower. And the that's the orientation map with the contours of the input weight put on top of it. Let me show you one that's a little more interesting. This is even squares, so you've got the retinotopic map. You can see there's these systematic changes in magnification. The net fanning weight. Now, the cytochrome oxidase blobs would correspond to peaks of the fanning. Right? Those are these red spots here, the large fanning weight. The spatial frequency and the mass are both in the same irreducible. They're both scalars. And in fact, that means either one's going to be large where the other's large, or vice versa. And the more common sense option is to have the peaks where you have large inputs correspond to where you have broader fields and lower spatial frequency. Because if you think about integrating lower spatial frequencies or integrating over a larger area, it's likely that they would have large, somewhat larger mass. And in fact, the cytochrome oxidase blobs seem to overlap, to occur in the same positions in the cortex as the low spatial frequency regions. The high spatial frequency regions occur in between the blobs, and the orientation pinwheels, half of them occur at the cytochrome oxidase blobs where the low spatial frequency regions are, and half of them occur where the high spatial frequency regions are. Okay? So that doesn't happen in this map, which is disappointing. You can see that the regions of here, the regions of low or of high spatial frequency occur in the middle of uniform orientation regions, not near the singularities. Things are a little more promising if we look at the P hexagons. So here's the orientation map, here's the retinotopic map, here's the netphanin. So where are the CO blobs now? They're these little peaks, these little star patterns. Okay, so those correspond to these regions here, and look, they are lying on top of the pinwheels. But the minima are lying on top of this double pinwheel. The double pinwheel shouldn't be there in the first place. And then the other pattern, the even hexagons with the others. The other plant form with the same symmetry, you can see it also has the D6 symmetry, but it's an entirely different physical structure. Here's the retinotopic map. Here's the netphanin. And now the cytochrome oxidase blobs have the right sort of hexagonal pattern, which you couldn't see in the first slide I showed. But this is more what they really look like. And so those are occurring here, and now those maxima of the netphanin weight, which are also the minima of the spatial frequency map, are lined up at the same positions as these double spirals, the double pinwheels. So, as you can see, it's not a finished story. It doesn't line up one to one, but there's a lot of similarity, and there's enough to think that there may be something here, which I'm hoping to wrap up over the summer and eventually publish my thesis on. Another possibility is to look at a combination of random plant forms, which look more like what the actual cortical maps do, although they aren't actually solutions to the equations. So here, I just thrown myself upon MATLAB to choose a random pattern, and it did a pretty good job. So I've got 12 different plane waves with random phases and directions. And each plane wave is one of the even isotopic components with everything, all the different maps lined up properly together. And so it makes pinwheels nicely. It makes a sort of a globular distribution of where you would see the cytochrome oxidase blobs. It makes a funny-looking retinotopic map. But it doesn't make any sort of systematic correlation between the two. This big CO blob would go here, which is that a pinwheel or... Well, that's sort of a pinwheel. This one goes here. I didn't know what this was going to show because it gives me a different answer every time. That one clearly doesn't. So if anybody... And there's a basic problem here, which is that the maps don't actually look like solutions. They don't look like planforms. Locally, they look like pieces of planforms, but globally, they're like lots of different planforms that are stuck together. And this is a general problem that comes up in pattern formation, where you have defects and you have the pattern is forming simultaneously at different parts of the area of the geometry, and how does it all fit together? If anybody really wants to take on the problem of forming these patterns, of forming patterns that gives us heterogeneous solutions, this would be a nice system to work on, to look at it, because we've got good data and we have a model that if you run a Monte Carlo simulation, well, I won't show it to you, but if you do a Monte Carlo simulation with the same K, you get the right kind of patterns. You don't get regular geometric tilings. Of course, you can't analyze them using this machinery the same way. So there's a gap, which I would love to help fill. On that note, I will end, and thank you for your attention. And sorry to go over a couple minutes.
So, questions?
Leon.
So, I'm not sure I understand the role of the Hebbian synapses. Supposing you imagined an animal that was just grown up in a visual environment in which it just saw small spots of light, never anything more complicated. Does that interact with the theory that you developed at all?
All that's needed in order to set up this very abstract pattern formation framework is that you have some kind of correlations in the input layer. Those correlations could be coming from traveling waves of calcium activity in the retina that are experience independent. They could be coming from any sort of localized activation that, as long as it's not white noise. So setting up the model can be done in a way that's experience independent, if you will. Now these maps start to form very early. They form the orientation map in cats, I think, is already forming around 2 to 3 weeks of age. And so they haven't had much appreciable... And in primates, it occurs even before there's any visual experience at all, because they're born later, their eyes open later. So these maps seem to be forming under some sort of intrinsic process. So the answer is no. It doesn't... It's not very satisfactory in terms of making up an experiment that you can kind of test.
Are there any symmetries in your original Hebbian learning dynamics that you would consider breaking in order to hopefully get rid of some of these problematic double rotation solutions?
That's an interesting question. So I think the most natural, what's probably really going on is what Paul talked about in his talk, which I wish had come after mine, because his talk in Valentine's mind. Formation of pre-patterns. So he talked about block waves, where if you've got some sort of like cytochrome oxidase distribution, some pre-existing non-uniformity, and then after that you try to form orientations. You can pin the spiral, you can pin the pinwheels on the cytochrome oxidase blocks. Right? Those cytochrome oxidase blocks, there's a recent paper showing that they are already developing by 2 weeks of visual experience before the orientation map starts to form. So this, you don't really start from Euclidean symmetry. And it may be possible to try to fit those together somehow and see how that would affect these patterns. I have no idea.
One question I have. From the idealization, would you choose even over odd in this case? It seemed like you were pointing out strengths and weaknesses of both transitions.
So the odd pattern does not include the scalar fields, like spatial frequency and the mass, so it can't explain anything about cytochrome oxidase, for example. I did some numerical simulations picking what I hoped were reasonable values and put it into... So I made an explicit numerical version of the matrix K and looked for bifurcations by varying the lateral connectivity strength and so on. And the patterns that I found were always off.
Okay.
So but I don't have any way to prove that that's what we expect.
So if I can segue into Andrew's talk from after the break, if you include, if you start from an isotropic rather than an anisotropic medium, then effectively both these are not bifurcated at the same time. And you get in one 12-dimensional space the competition. Something of interest there.
Good. Okay.
Any other questions?
So your model was purely feed-forward interaction from, you said, either retina or the LGN to the primary visual cortex, but there are massive feedback connections from the visual cortex, at least back to the LGN. Could you speculate on the role of these feedback connections?
Yes, they were put there to vex theorists. To make life difficult. So I have lateral connectivity in this Mexican head interaction within the cortex. Probably a better way to approach modeling the formation of anatomical structures in the cortex is to think not just about one layer or one sheet like V1 with layers in it, but think of V1, V2, V4, and the LGN as themselves forming a layered structure with a common retinotopic organization which will give you now a higher dimensional vector field and more intricate coupling within that vector field, describing the development of structures in all those different layers, either at the same time or sequentially, and that way you can incorporate the feedback explicitly. So I haven't gone there, but it's a serious drawback to this kind of approach not to include feedback. You're absolutely right.
Okay, I think we should go ahead and break. Thank you again.